Right, so let me go to Job and to chapter 1. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. His sons used to hold feasts in their homes on their birthdays, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would make arrangements for them to be purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, "Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." This was Job's regular custom. Then the scene changes. One day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered, "From roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But now stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he shall surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, everything he has is in your power, but on the man himself do not lay a finger." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord, back into the present again. One day when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the eldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were ploughing, the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabians attacked and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword. I alone escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The fire of God fell from the heavens and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another came and said, "The Chaldeans formed 3 raiding parties and swept down on your camels and made off with them. They put your servants to the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." And while he was still speaking, yet another came. "Your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house when suddenly a mighty wind swept in the desert and struck the 4 corners of the house. It collapsed on them and they are dead. And I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground and worshipped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." And in all of this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. That has to be one of the most fascinating passages in Scripture. And it's a book of 42 chapters. And the second chapter goes on to talk about God had said, "No, you're not allowed to touch Job himself." And then Satan says, "Well, of course he's going to still praise you when he himself is all right." But then God says, "Okay, you're not allowed to kill him, but you can do what you like to him." And so he ends up really poorly. And you know, and just, you know, really miserable in the midst of it all. And then to make things worse, his wife comes along and says, "Why don't you just curse God and die and get it over with?" She's a real help, isn't she, in that situation? And he says, I'm not doing that. I'm going to keep praising God. And then from chapter 3 onwards, right through to 40-41, you have Job's comforters coming along and entering into really a theological debate with him, where they try to figure out, why is he suffering so badly? Why, God, is this happening? And the answer is, you must be a terrible sinner. And Job rightly says, hang on a moment, I'm not a terrible sinner. Job's comforters say, well, the fact that you don't think you're a sinner means you're really proud, so you're a really big sinner. He has this debate with the three friends, and another person comes along and again tries to argue with him. And Job is just standing his ground, no, actually, the normal answer that I've done something wrong to cause this badness in my life is not the answer. And then God answers from heaven and gives him this great revelation of himself and his character and his greatness, and basically asks him, who do you think you are to ask me those questions? Which isn't really an answer to Job's question. But Job said, I have no right to speak, really. You're right. I'm just going to submit to you. And then he gets back into a place where he's even richer and even more blessed than he was before. I'll come to the last chapter before I finish the session, but I want to just go back to the chapter 1 for a moment and start with this thought that in the land of Uz, where is Uz on the map? Anyone know? The reason you don't know is because it's not there.
Oh.
Okay, there is no land of Uz that we know of. Which then leads to the question, is Job a made-up story to help act as a vehicle for using that debate, to debate the issue? Is it a kind of a parable, extended or allegory? That's the way myths and legends work. If you've ever been to Northern Ireland and the Giant's Causeway, you'll have heard of a certain gentleman by the name of Finn McCool. Yeah? Finn McCool, the giant, who picked a fight with the Scottish giant, Benadonna or something like that, they called him. Doesn't matter who the Scottish one was called. The Irish one's the one that matters. So they build this causeway to have a fisticuffs. And then Finn McCool looks and says, actually, this was a bad idea. He's really big, that guy from Scotland. And a bit vicious, though, Scottish. So he decides to say to his wife, dress me up as a baby and put me in the crib. And then when the giant turns up the door and says, I'm looking for the giant, show me in the crib dressed up as a baby. And he'll say, gosh, if that's how big the baby is, how big's the daddy? And so he runs back across, dismantling the causeway as he goes. Hence we have James Causeway. No, that's a story that's made up. Now, there may have been somebody called Finn McCool, and he may have been quite tall, and he may have done a bit of landscaping, but the story is made up to try and explain a factual reality. What are these stones doing? Because they're quite incredible. How do we explain this phenomenon? So, in every generation, in every time and place, human beings, like you and me, have had to deal with the fact that life doesn't always go right. The problem of suffering and evil. Technical word, theodicy. That's the technical term in theology. The problem of suffering and evil. Why is God all-powerful? He can do whatever he wants, and he's good, and he's loving, so he wants to do what's best for us, and yet evil things happen and bad things happen. That's basically the philosophical problem of suffering and evil. If we were trained counsellors looking at the book of Job, we'd say that the three friends make a classical mistake. is that when they start to have this debate about the problem of suffering evil, that was the wrong time to have the debate when the poor person's in the middle of it all. Because there's a difference between the philosophical problem and the emotional problem. Sometimes people try to have a debate about the theology or the philosophy, when actually it's an emotional issue and you just have to sit with it. That's really what they need to do. They need to sit with it, not try and debate it. But then what happens when we're in silence? We get, silence is awkward, isn't it? And so we then feel we need to fill it with something, and they fill it with a lot, 40 odd chapters. Yeah. So it's a book that's written probably quite late on, because it resembles the sort of thinking that's probably post-exilic, and trying to wrestle with the age-old problem of suffering and evil that every generation's dealt with. And it draws the picture of this Job who's got this fantastic family and fantastic business, and it all goes wrong. It all goes wrong, and in those days, the philosophy of the age was that if you're really rich, then God's blessed you. If you're really poor, then you must be really evil. Now, in one sense, you would want to say we've grown up out of that thinking, but actually in popular mythology and superstition, people who have something good happen to them and they'll say, oh, the gods are looking good kindly upon me. You know, so they see a blessing or something good happening as being a blessing from God. Or if something goes wrong, somebody's got it out for me. That superstition is still there built into our humanity, that good things happen, the gods are looking kindly on me. Bad things happen, oh, I've done something wrong. What have I done? Where's it gone wrong? Why is this happening? Now, Job is an interesting one in that it draws back the curtain, what's going on behind the scenes. And you've got this picture of heaven, where you've got all the angels coming in and doing a kind of daily report to the manager, to the top man, to God. And interestingly, Satan's in there with them. Yeah, he's coming in to report too. And notice that he's not able to do anything unless God allows him to. Do you notice that? Mm-hmm. Now, this is the theology of Job. So he says, you know, of course Job blesses you. Look how good he has it. And so God says you can do whatever you like to him. He gives him the authority to do that. But on the man himself, he can't do anything. So he's limited in what he can do. And in the second chapter, okay, have a go at the man, but you're allowed to kill him. And so again, Satan then becomes, in the theology of Job, someone who is under the control of God and can't do anything unless God allows him to. Now that's a very different picture from the popular theology that sort of says, here's God, here's Satan, and they're enemies, and they've got to deal with each other. That's a very different picture indeed that you're given in the book of Job. But then that sometimes the appropriate response then, if you want to use the theology of Job, is when things are going a bit tough, the response isn't to sort of bind the devil and try and resist the devil, whatever. Sometimes the response is to say, God, I don't know why you've let this through. I don't know why you're allowing this to happen. There may be something you're trying to teach me through this. There may be something you're trying to do in me through this. I don't know, but you've allowed this through. That's the theology of Job, really. You've let this happen. Not that you've caused it to happen, not that you've made it happen, but you've allowed it. It's what's called as permissive will in theology. Which, you know, again, raises all sorts of questions about the nature of God and the character of God. So the other thing just to say, and this is an aside of this, wealth being seen as a blessing. Part of me wants to instantly say, no, well, of course that's rubbish. There are really good, godly people who are really poor with the physical things of the world, the material things of the world, and their material well-being or otherwise has got nothing to do with how rich they are spiritually. I think I've said to you before that when I was in Zimbabwe, some of the richest, deepest, most beautiful, rich Christians I've ever met hadn't got a penny to roll between their hands. So they didn't see, actually, poverty led to greater sense of need and dependency on God and a depth of relationship with God. The other thing I've noticed is that, you know, in the some of the monastic traditions, like the Benedictines or the different, you know, the Franciscans, a vow of poverty or of simplicity is part of their discipline. So that actually intentionally making yourself not rich with material things is a good thing. Having said that, I remember this when I was living up in Aston. A lot of people that were living in Aston, which had originally been a mining village, was now quite a dormitory town, a bit like, I'll stick with Aston for a moment. But most of those people at some stage had started off their life in somewhere like Carbrook or Addercliffe, which were the inner city sort of industrial working class areas. And then when they'd, you know, as good godly people had given themselves, every effort in life to do better, they moved out to maybe somewhere like Darnall or then out to Handsworth, and eventually they got out as far as Aston as the place they were going to. Some even went as far as Worksop, you know. But, you know, there was that sense of the further the way, the better you did, the further out you moved. So it was a social mobility, literally, geographically. But there's a lot of evidence from Methodist history, and I think Salvation Army history, I'm going to say as well, that indicates in communities where they work, say in inner cities, led people to faith, encouraged them to live lives worthy of the Lord and to do all things as they're doing it to the Lord, to live moral, upright lives, hardworking lives, they often would do better financially and then move out into the suburbs. Yeah? So all around the country, there are Methodist churches, Baptist churches, Salvation Army churches, where the people don't actually live near to their church, but come in the city centres or town centres, but then come in. So there is something there about coming to faith, living under the grace of God, seeking to treat your money as something that is to be stewarded because it belongs to God ultimately, living a life that's worthy of the Lord, doing all things as if you're doing them to the Lord, working hard, getting a reputation for being trustworthy and dependable, so maybe getting promotion. And slowly but surely, life does get better. So there is an argument there that sort of says there is a link between faith and well-being and that sort of stuff. But back to Job for a minute. That was a little tangent aside, which I thought was just an interesting thing to throw in there. Back to Job for a minute. So he has this horrendous experience. They debate the problem of suffering and evil. There's some real gems in the middle of that book. You know, the hymn we sing sometimes around Easter, "I know that my Redeemer lives." Yeah? Mm-hmm. That phrase comes from the heart of Job. The passage is around about 39-40, where God reveals himself to Job as very, very powerful, beautiful language of praise to God. But I want to bring you now to chapter 42, the last chapter, and just comment on that before we finish. So Job 42, "I know," says Job, "that you can do all things. No purpose of yours can be thwarted. You asked, 'Who is this that obscures my plans without knowledge?' Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. You said, 'Listen now, and I will speak. I will question you, and you shall answer me. My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore I despise myself and repent. in dust and ashes. That's a beautiful way of Job saying, I've met with God here and my picture of God has changed. It's never going to be the same again. It's kind of a conversion experience. I thought I knew God, but I've had this experience that says I haven't got a clue what I was talking about. And there's a sense in which the better you know God, the more theology and reading, Bible study and reading and experience of God you have, the less confident you are in what you think you know. And the more likely you are to be humble and say, I have this conviction, I believe this, but you know what, I could be wrong. Because God's bigger than I could ever describe him to be, and his ways are beyond my understanding. And yes, I have these convictions. This is where I stand right now, and I can do no other. But actually, God could come along and just completely blow that map up anytime he wants to, because he's much bigger than that. It's like an ant trying to grasp the size of an elephant. You know, it's too big for us. But goes on. After the Lord had said these things to Job, he said to Eliphaz the Temanite, one of the friends, I am angry with you and your two friends because you have not spoken the truth about me. So the comforters who came along with the good theology, I am angry with you because you have not spoken what is true about me. As my servant Job has. So Job is the one who says, listen, the theology arguments aren't working for me. It doesn't fit with reality. And I'm disagreeing with you. And he's the one actually, on paper you'd have said, Job's the one who's got it wrong here. These guys have got all the arguments lined up. And God says, I'm actually angry with you because you thought you'd got it all worked out, which you hadn't. You didn't speak what was true of me. But actually Job has. So now take 7 bulls, 7 rams, and go to my servant Job and sacrifice a burnt offering for yourselves. My servant Job will pray for you, and I will accept his prayer and not deal with you according to your folly. You have not spoken the truth about me as my servant Job has. So Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and so far the Naamathite did what the Lord told them, and the Lord accepted Job's prayer. I find that interesting. I find that very interesting. Well, no, I don't find that interesting. I find it incredibly challenging. Because, you know, any of us who, as preachers or as worship leaders or as Sunday school teachers or anyone who shares in Christian witness with someone else, I am angry with you because you have not spoken about me what is true. When we use our words, we draw pictures of what God's like. And we have to do that with humility. And we have to do that with great care. Because God was angry with them. Because they had not spoken what is true of them. That's why I find it kind of interesting when people come to me sometimes and say, I don't agree with you. Who are you to say that? If they listen, I did not say anything I said with great care and attention because I do not want the anger of God. Doesn't mean I can't get it wrong. But I've got to where I've got to with great care. And, you know, Not taking things for granted, and not spoken flippantly. So the book ends with him being restored to his blessings again. So the book of Job, well worth reading, well worth sort of teasing out, because it really does touch on an issue that every generation has to deal with. Issues around wealth and poverty, issues around suffering and evil. Issues around how we speak about God and often think we've got God worked out. But actually what we realise ultimately is we've only got a part of the jigsaw. We've got one jigsaw piece and it's a 50 million piece jigsaw. So that's the book of Job.